Psalm 3. I was going to look and see what page it was on in the Bible, the Pew Bible, and I forgot. Before we read the psalm itself, we need to read the superscript. That is the little heading. If you're not familiar with the term superscript, the superscript is the heading that gets printed between the chapter title and the actual text of the psalm itself. Depending on the Bible you've got, it's probably in bold or italics. And when they're included, they give us information about the background of the psalm we're going to read. And above Psalm 3, we find written, "Morning prayer of trust in God, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son." It tells us a little bit about where David's life was when he wrote this psalm. There's a specific time of life. Specifically, during the sort of nascent civil war that happened between he and Absalom. And that being the case, I thought it would be prudent of us to go and read that particular portion of scripture before going through Psalm 3. So don't lose your place in Psalm 3, but find 2 Samuel 15. 2 Samuel 15 is where we should find that story, the historical account of when Absalom rebelled against his father David. If you look, there's actually at least, I think, three, maybe four chapters about Absalom and his conspiracy to seize the throne from his father David. We're not going to read the whole thing. We're just going to read maybe the first 16 verses. So I'm going to read in 2 Samuel 15, 1 through 16. As background to understanding Psalm 3. "Now it came about that after this, that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, 'From what city are you?' And he would say, 'Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel.' Then Absalom would say to him, 'See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king.' Moreover, Absalom would say, 'Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice.' And when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment, and so Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. Now it came about, at the end of 40 years, that Absalom said to the king, 'Please let me go and pay my vow which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I was living at Geshur in Aram, saying, "If the Lord shall indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord." The king said to him, "Go in peace." And so he arose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, 'Absalom is king in Hebron.' Then 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem, who were invited and went innocently, and they did not know anything. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city Giloh, while he was offering the sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. Then a messenger came to David, saying, 'The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom.' David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, 'Arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us will escape from Absalom. Go in haste, or he will overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword.' Then the king's servant said to the king, 'Behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king chooses.' So the king went out and all his household with him, but the king left 10 concubines to keep the house." So before we go back to Psalm 3, let's briefly note the background that's happening here. David is the king and he's ruling over Israel. But his son becomes disenchanted with his role and he forms this conspiracy. I have all kinds of questions about the background to this. You know, how did Absalom get away with this for so long? What was David thinking letting this build? Why didn't he just crush? All kind of questions. I'm not going to go into them now. We can read the rest of 2 Samuel 15, 16, 17, and on into 18 if you want the rest of the story. You and Paul Harvey can check that out later. But for tonight, I just want to note that the conspiracy happens and David is actually forced to flee from the palace. He's running away from the capital city. He's running away with his family. He says the royal household, indicating loyal servants, those kind of things. And whatever group of citizens and people from the capital city and the palace remain loyal to him. And this is happening because Absalom, his son, has ignited a rebellion against him. He's flattered and cajoled and tricked and lied his way into a following among the people that has grown to the point that David fears for his life and the life of his family if he doesn't leave. And so he runs. And what we just read in 2 Samuel 15 is the beginning stages of a civil war that's going to go on between David and Absalom over the next several chapters of scripture in 2 Samuel, between David and his followers and Absalom and his followers. And the army itself became divided, with some of the commanders and some of the advisors going with Absalom and some of the commanders and some of the advisors staying with David. And at the very, very beginning here, David is losing. He's losing the war to the point that he and his household have to flee the city, abandoning the palace, and they end up camping away from Jerusalem in the surrounding area. I mean, you talk about a bad day. I haven't had a bad day like that yet. It kind of makes my bad days not seem so bad. But this is what's happening in David's life when he writes the words that we know as Psalm 3. So keeping that in mind, let's flip back over to Psalm 3, and we'll see how David reacted to these things. Look at verse 1. He says, O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the one who lifts my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have smitten all my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be upon your people. Knowing the background of 2 Samuel 15 puts this in a little sharper contrast, and it lends an urgency and maybe a desperation, a note of desperation to things that we wouldn't normally get if you just plunked down and read Psalm 3 by itself. You look back at verse 1, that background information of Absalom's rebellion gives us a little more insight into David's situation when he says, O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. I mean, when David says that his foes are many, your Bible might say that, my foes are many. He isn't kidding. At this point, half of the army has deserted him and followed Absalom. The people themselves thought that God had abandoned David, and so they sided with Absalom too. The general thought around the population seems to have been that David's day was past and that Absalom was the future. And if you read the rest of the story in those other three chapters, there's a sizable force and a sizable group of people lined up against David because they've thrown in their lot with Absalom. He had only a small number of loyal citizens. He had only half of his army on his side. But it doesn't really seem to have mattered all that much to David. I mean, if you look down at verse 3, this is what David says. All of that doesn't matter because you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the one who lifts my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. See, David looked at the enemies that were surrounding him and literally chasing him out of town, and he didn't see them. He didn't look first to his army for security. He didn't, woe is me, because he lost that. He was not chiefly concerned with the affections or the opinions of the people who just yesterday had been his loyal subjects. In the verses we just read, we note that David looks first to the Lord. And his immediate concern is to acknowledge his dependence on God, to voice his trust in God rather than men. Nobody would have blamed David, at least I wouldn't have blamed him, if he would have been a little bit, I don't know, worried. You lose half your army, you lose your subjects, you lose your palace. That wasn't David. Verse 7, what comes next, is one of those verses that maybe tends to trouble the sensitive spirits of some because it contains the words of David as he calls down God's judgment and a curse on his enemies. Look at verse 7. Arise, O Lord, and save me, O my God, for you have smitten all my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked, and salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be upon your people. You see, David is writing in the past tense. You have smitten my enemies. You have shattered their teeth. But this is in the middle of fleeing, in the middle of being routed. David expresses his confidence in God for his deliverance to such a degree that he writes in the past tense. And I read that and I wonder, how can David be so very sure of God's intervention on his behalf? How can he be so sure of his own ultimate success? See, the rebellion of Absalom was not a minor thing. It wasn't a little blip on the radar for David. It was a major blow against his kingdom. It was a significant threat to the country, to the point that where the king abandoned the capital. But one of the keys to understanding why David uses such harsh language here in calling down judgment on his enemies, and also why he can speak confidently of God's ultimate deliverance, is to remember why David was king in the first place. The teens just went through Kings with Steve Thurman in Sunday school, and one of the common things of the Kings that only last maybe a few years or even a few days in some places is the king who attained his throne by violent means sometimes loses his throne by violent means. David didn't kill, scheme, and plot his way into the throne. David was king because God selected him personally to be king. God brought David to the throne, and then he made promises to David about the kingdom, about his family, about his rule, about the enduring nature of his kingdom. David was not king because he was the strongest or the best, or because he killed the last guy. David was king because God made him the king. So when Absalom rebels against David, he's not just rebelling against his father. He was, in fact, actually rebelling against the actual will of God, as expressed clearly to David and his people. This is why David is so harsh, but it's also why he's so confident. Because he was not only defending himself from attack, he was defending God from attack. He knew for an absolute fact that God wanted David to be king, not Absalom. And he knew this was true because God had told him and God had been the one to make it happen. I think that is what informs David's confidence and also what brings about the he's speaking harshly about his enemies because they're not just his enemies. They're the confirmed enemies of God. At this point, I want to do something that's a little bit different, maybe a tad speculative. It's not an unassailable fact of history, but there is a lot of Jewish tradition that's handed down through Jewish studies that Psalms 3 and 4 were composed by David at the same time. The time while he was fleeing from Absalom. Psalm 4, if you look at the top, doesn't have that same explicitly historical superscript as Psalm 3 does. The superscript in Psalm 4 just gives singing instructions. For the choir director on stringed instruments, a Psalm of David. But when you combine the internal witness between the two psalms being similar in nature in terms of their consistency between the two chapters and the Jewish tradition and history that's handed down that says these two psalms were composed by David during the same time when he was running from Absalom, the case for considering them together becomes pretty convincing. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to read both Psalm 3 and Psalm 4. We're going to consider them both together. So let's keep reading as if we never stopped and just pick up at the beginning of Psalm 4. where David writes, "Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. O sons of men, how long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. Tremble and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord. Many are saying, who will show us any good? Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. You have put gladness in my heart, more than when their grain and new wine abound. In peace I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety." There's a lot going on in this psalm, and the biggest challenge that we face in trying to make sense of it is, who is David talking to? Who is he speaking about in each verse? Because he kind of bounces all over the place. In a couple different places, he's speaking explicitly to God, but then some other places he seems to be talking to people that he likes, and other times people that he doesn't like, his enemies. Who's David talking to? Now, I'm fairly certain that there are all sorts of, advanced literary techniques that can be used to solve this little interpretive puzzle. And no doubt, if you had a good associate pastor, he would be able to wow you and dazzle you with big words and impressive techniques. You don't have that guy, right? You have me. Me and what Mark always calls, what is it, 5 cent words? 50 cent words. That's right. I got 50 cent words, Mark. That's it. You got small bites. I'm slow. And so when there's a complex thing to be grasped, you know what I need? I need a picture, right? I need books with pictures in them. This used to happen all the time to me when I was working construction. I worked for this guy. His name was Matt, and he was a math and an engineering genius. We built a pole barn that was bigger than this room, and he drew it on a napkin. I'm like, we're gonna do what? So he would tell me, he would give me a job. It would be working. He'd say, "Okay, Ernie, go and cut blah blah blah. 7/8 at 3/4 according to the square of 0 - 12 and the exterior edge of 7." And he'd look and say, "Does that make sense?" I'd say no. And I'd get a pencil and a scrap of plywood and I'd draw me a picture. And so he'd kind of, sketch it out. He'd just make it like this. I'd say, when you say that in the first place, I can do that. And so that's what we would do. So what we need today to help us make sense of Psalm 4 is I need a picture. Okay, this is Psalm 4. You didn't know that by looking at it, did you? I never really got over children's church. But this is what we have, right? We have on the left, this is the city of Jerusalem, right? That's a palace. There's a little buildings in the palace. The royal palace. Absalom is in the city. He's wearing the crown and the sword. Happy as can be, because he thinks that he's the king of the mountain now. That's why he gets the smiley face and the sword and the crown. But then we have David down on the other side of Israel. I don't know exactly where he was. Doesn't tell us. Somewhere outside. He's forced to flee. He's living in a camp. That's why he gets a tent and a campfire instead of a house with a chimney. And remember, David is running away. He's fleeing the city. He's living outside in the wilderness. And so I picture David across the valley at what he hopes is a safe distance, having run away from Absalom, looking back at the city. At various times in the psalm then, that's why David has the frowny face. He's unhappy. He doesn't have a sword or a crown or a palace. But at various times in the psalm, David speaks, and he speaks either to God. We're going to see some prayers that go up to the Lord. He speaks to his enemies in the city. We'll see some words go across to men he's not happy with. And sometimes he speaks to the people who follows him, who followed loyally with him. So with this in mind, and this is the word picture that's in our heads, let's read through Psalm 4 again and see if we can identify who David is speaking to in the psalm. Okay, look at verse 1. "Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. Here in verse 1, we find David speaking directly to God. He's not talking to his friends. He's not talking to his enemies. He's appealing directly to God himself. He's essentially begging God to hear his prayers. He says, "Answer me when I call, O God." He acknowledges that his situation is rotten. He knows he's in trouble. He doesn't hide from the fact, he doesn't hide from God the fact that he's completely dependent upon God for help, for deliverance, for anything else. He needs God to relieve him. He needs God to be gracious. So as you read verse 1, picture David looking up to heaven, pleading with God, keeping in mind that he's in a desperate situation and he needs some help. Let's keep reading. Look at verse 2. "O sons of men, how long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself, and the Lord hears when I call to him." If you have an NIV or maybe what's the other one? An ESV talks about in verse 2, "O sons of men, how long," they talk about turning glory into shame. So David is addressing men who have caused his honor to become shame or his glory to become a reproach. He's speaking to people whom he describes as those who love delusions. So with these verses, verses 2 and 3, it seems most likely that at this point, David has turned back and is speaking to his enemies who are residing in Jerusalem now. He fled, Absalom and his group moves in, and it seems as though David has turned and is speaking to them. These are the people who, just yesterday in David's life, they were saying, "O king, live forever." They were proclaiming themselves to be his loyal subjects. And now they've rebelled against him. And he's addressing them because they love delusions, he says. "You think you're following the king? That's a delusion. You think you're safe from God? That's a delusion. You think this is going to end well, that treachery will end well for you? That's a delusion," David says, "and you love your delusions." Today, they've run David out of town. Today, they're colluding with his renegade son in this civil war, trying to kill David. So when we read verses 2 and 3, keep in mind that David is speaking to them as he faces backwards towards Jerusalem, where he's thinking of where he's just come from, the city and the palace and the people that he's been forced to leave behind. Let's keep reading. Verse 4 comes next. "Tremble and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord." See, these verses seem addressed to an entirely different set of people. Whereas in verses 2 and 3, David is speaking with a certain amount of, I don't know, you call it disdain, I don't know, you call it attitude, whatever you call it, talking to his enemies. Now the tone of his voice, the tone of his words is gentle and leading and comforting. In verses 2 and 3, David was speaking to those who had, quote, turned his glory to shame. But here he's speaking to people who are angry. In verses 4 and 5, David exhorts these people to do what is right and to trust in the Lord. Verses 4 and 5 are most likely David speaking to the people who remain loyal with him. And we read in 2 Samuel 15 about the servants and the people who said, "We're ready to do whatever you need, king." And he says, "We gotta go." And he said, "Okay, let's go." And they went with the king. They fled the city with him rather than turn against him. And these are the loyal followers that are now suffering from their choice. David exhorts them in verses 4 and 5 to do not be angry. I'm reading out of the New American Standard, and it says, "Tremble and do not sin." Other translations, I think, again, the NIV and the ESV, say, "Be not angry," or "Do not be angry," or "Be angry and do not sin," something like that. What David doesn't want, he's counseling his people. He doesn't want his people to channel their anger over what has happened into sinfulness or into useless agitation, kind of that fury that you sit. He doesn't want them to dwell in bitterness. He doesn't want them to sit out in the field and just soak their mind in the poison of anger. He says, "Tremble, be angry at what has happened, but do not sin." Instead, he tells them to turn to God with their emotions and to trust in God's deliverance. He says, tremble or be angry and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord. You know what the right thing to do is, David says. So let's focus on doing that. So as we read and think about verses 4 and 5, let's keep in mind that David is speaking here to the people who have gone with him, the people who have stayed loyal. So now let's read in verse 6 and see what else David has to say. Many are saying, who will show us any good? Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. You have put gladness in my heart, more than when their grain and new wine abound. In peace I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety. In these last verses, David is again speaking to God. At the end of verse 6, he even names this, Lord, I'm talking to you. Verses 6 and verse 8, he names the Lord by name. He asks for God's favor. He says, let the light of your countenance shine upon us. We want to see your face, God, because we need your help, and we're not going to make it out of this without your grace. He asks for God's favor. He acknowledges the people's doubt, right? He says, many are saying, who will show us any good? That may give us some insight into the fact that the people went with David, but maybe they weren't exactly sure how this was going to turn out. That David had people in his own camp who were looking at him going, did I do the right thing? Should I have stayed? How is this going to end well? Maybe I should have stayed in Jerusalem. Maybe Absalom isn't going to be. David says, Lord, they're saying, who's going to show us any good? He acknowledges the people's doubt. But ultimately, he expresses that same trust in God that we saw from chapter 3 just a few minutes ago. He expresses his trust in God, and he is confident that these things will work out because he believes in God's power to control and deliver. He believes that God is able to override the actions of Absalom and his men, and he rejoices in that, and he allows himself, he even says, gladness. You have put gladness in my heart because the Lord makes him dwell in safety. And these last few verses, verses 6, 7, and 8 that we just read, they're a remarkable degree of trust and faith in God. I wonder how many of us, I wonder if I could presently emulate this example. I mean, here's David on the run. He's hunted by his own son. He's deserted by his army, right? Officers that were swearing their loyalty to him yesterday are hunting him today. If you read the rest of the story, as he left town, people lined up and they pelted him with rocks and dirt. It says they threw down clods of dirt on him. One of these army officers, you got to love this guy. He says, you want me to go kill him? Guys are throwing rocks at the king as he's walking out. And the army officer says, I'll kill him. And David says, no, leave him alone. God will deal with him. And these are people who only yesterday wouldn't dare to even approach David's presence without fear and trembling. And this is how they treat him today. He's living in the fields. He's living camping in tents while he runs for his life, surrounded by people who are questioning his leadership. They're angry at what has happened. And yet, in the middle of all of that, he says, in peace, I will both lie down and sleep. Now, there's a distinction there. I will lie down and I will sleep. You ever lie down and not be able to sleep because you're worried about something, or you're angry about something, or you're anxious about something, or your brain just won't turn off, whether something good or usually something bad? David says, not me. In peace, I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. I mean, that's an amazing statement of faith in the power and the ability of God to control. Now that we've gotten ourselves to the end of this chapter, I hope we're able to see a little more clearly and pick out the various degrees of speech and who David is speaking to here. David is caught out in the open, out in the run, and here, this is kind of how I see it going down. You know, David is here, he wishes he was there, but he's got three distinct directions he's looking in. He's looking up to God, he's looking back at his enemies, he's looking forward to his people. with a little bit of sanctified imagination, I see David running from the city of Jerusalem. We know that's a fact. We read it in 2 Samuel 15. The superscript of Psalm 3 confirms for us that that's what was happening when he wrote these words, running from Absalom's civil war and the army that deserted him. He stops at night to camp. He wanders outside of his tent. He stares up at the sky. He's just had the worst day of his life. Can it possibly get any worse? And he looks up to heaven and he cries out directly to the Lord. And he says, "Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress. Now be gracious to me and hear my prayer." I mean, he's in distress. He's begging God. He finishes his prayer. And as he lowers his head and he opens his eyes, he looks in the city off in the distance. And what does he see? City of Jerusalem. This morning he was living in that palace. This morning he was safe behind those walls. And the sight of that city looms large, taunting in the night. And he looks at that city and he knows the people that are there. And he knows their mindset of his enemies. But he also knows that they're not just his enemies, that they're enemies of God as well. So he's looking at that city and knowing who's there and knowing what they're in. And he says in verse 2, "O sons of men, how long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is a worthless and aim at deception? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him." It's almost like he's not really threatening them with God, but he is. Because he knows what is coming for those who rebel against God. And he finishes speaking against his enemies. He turns and he's going to go back to his camp with the people that have come with him. But as he turns to head back, he can't help but see and consider his own people. And he looks around at the people being dejected, defeated. They're angry. They're despairing. And he knows it. And so he looks to the camp of his followers who are as yet still loyal to him. And he says to them in verse 4, "Tremble, but do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord." So he's leading his people. He's addressing them to do what is right. And when he finishes speaking to them, it's almost like he can't quit. He looks back up to heaven. He looks back up to God and he addresses God one more time starting in verse 6. And he says to the Lord, "Many are saying, who will show us any good? Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. You have put gladness in my heart more than when their grain and new wine abound. In peace I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety." And from there, at the end of verse 8, that's all he's got to say. He goes on with his life, literally just trying to survive another day. Hopefully, this helps us make sense of these couple of chapters. But once we've made sense of it, what are we supposed to do with it? Right? How does Psalm 4 fit into my life and your life? You've probably not had the experience of being a deposed king. In fact, I'm actually rather confident that you have yet to have the particular experience of being a king and then being dethroned. But if Baptists are allowed to bet, I don't know if we're allowed to bet, but if we are, I'm willing to bet that there's a time in your life when things did not go the way you thought they should go. Maybe you were even dead set confident this is what God wants, and it didn't happen. I'll bet you've had a period of time like that. If you haven't, just give it a while. You will. It's going to happen. What Psalm 4 does is Psalm 4, when we understand the time period of David's life that he was in, and we think about the circumstances he was going through, and we recognize that what was happening to David was not only terrible, but also most definitely not God's will for his life, Psalm 4 gives us an example to follow. Psalm 4 shows us a pattern to emulate when those times come to us. Because we're not going to get deposed as a king, but you might get fired. We're not going to be hunted to the death by our son, but you might have somebody at work that's got it out for you. You might not be fleeing for your life, but you might have a neighbor who's just a crank and wants to nitpick everything about the site. I'm not talking about you, Paul. I have wonderful neighbors. Paul on one side and an empty house on the other. It's great. If I don't mow the lawn, Paul doesn't complain. If he doesn't mow the lawn, I don't complain. It's great. What David does, because I know that not everybody's as lucky as I am in the neighbor department. David shows us the right way to respond to attacks. David gives us a pattern of life to emulate when life knocks us back a few paces. I mean, what do we see in verse 1? We see David crying out to the Lord in sheer desperation. He doesn't sugarcoat things. He looks to God and he prays to God in this raw, open way that painfully and plainly acknowledges his situation. He gives voice to the circumstances he finds himself in. He's not sanitizing his prayers, trying to say what he thinks might sound more spiritual to the Lord. He prays to God about his struggle, and he plainly asks for help. In verse 2, thinking about his enemies, what we saw is that David doesn't take things personally. I mean, he's offended, yes, but he also keeps his own life in perspective as one of God's children. And the focus that David displays, a focus on the Lord, is remarkable, even when responding to the attacks that are on himself. And that comes through when he begins to address his own people in verses 4 and 5. What does he tell them? He says, yeah, you're angry, but don't sin. Tremble, but offer right sacrifices. Do the right thing. Do not allow your anger over what has happened to you to lead you into a sinful place. That's a tough one for us when these things happen. I mean, I'm sure you are not like this, of course. But for other people who are less spiritual than us, problems in life can easily devolve into a sinful attitude. Even in extreme case, a rejection of God himself. And I don't know how it happens. Maybe you have a falling out with someone and you begin to really not like them. And really not liking them becomes to hate for them, to the point where you won't even talk to them. Or worse, you start to talk about them when they're not around. Gossip. Your anger has turned to sin and hate in your heart. Maybe you even go so far as you begin to seek out ways to subvert them and you look for opportunities to get even. David gives us a better way. Our sin eats us alive. We desperately need a better way of dealing with it when these things happen in life. David gives that to us in Psalm 4. And his writing in Psalm 4 is instructive for us in that David did none of that when it happened to him. He avoided the trap of sinful anger. He avoided the trap of personal retribution, of getting even, of taking the offenses personally. He looked to God for vindication. He trusted in the Lord for deliverance, in God's timing and not his own. It's difficult to trust God in dark days, especially when there's no answer. Right? It's frustrating to pray and pray and pray for help from the Lord without growing sinfully weary. Right? I don't know how long David lived in that tent. I don't know how long he prayed this prayer before he got the deliverance that he knew was coming. But David reminds us that God is in control. He reminds us that God's word and God's will can be trusted to help when we need them most. And in those last few verses that we read, verses 6, 7, and 8, David expressed that confidence and dependence on the Lord. And he expressed his ultimate belief that God would come through with vindicate him with deliverance. So as we end things tonight, having read Psalm 3 and Psalm 4, considering them together, What they give us is an example to follow of how we can make our way through those dark days in life. When the circumstances that happen to us are not pleasant, we don't like them, and maybe we've even been wronged, and they come on us unexpectedly. But more than just teaching us how to survive those days, Psalm 4 teaches us how to live through them without sin, how to live in them to the glory of God. In Romans 15, way later in the Bible, Paul wrote about the Old Testament, and he said, "The things which were written before were written down as examples for us, for our instruction, that through the testimony of the Scriptures," meaning the Old Testament, "we might have hope." Let's take Psalm 4 this week as we leave this place, right? Jim was right when he prayed, "We've had a great Sunday." Well, let's take that this week as we leave here and we rejoin our separate lives and scatter into the community. Let's take Psalm 4 with us as we leave and let it guide us through the circumstances that are painful. But let's let it guide us to a place of hope and trust in the Lord, rather than a place of anger and vindication of ourselves. That's what Psalm 4 does for us. Let's do that this week.